to Stand to Reason's hashtag STRAsk podcast. I'm Amy Hall and Greg Kokel's here with me, and we're here to answer the questions that you send in on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk, or you send through our website with the hashtag STRAsk. Either way, I will see it. All right, Greg.
All right, Amy.
Here's a question from R. Hall. I recently heard a preacher refer to God in a sermon as the Divine Mother. It was on Mother's Day. Is this biblical?
No. Next. There is a reason God has for referring to himself as Father. That's why he does it. What is the reason? I'm not entirely sure, but God's not arbitrary. Now, we know that he has, in a certain sense, one could say maternal qualities, because he is characterized like that in different places. He is described, I think, in Psalm 91, like a hen stretching her pinions, her feathers, over her brood. And there are other occasions like that. But when God characterizes himself, he usually does in the male form, as a father or as a husband to the bride, which is Israel in the Old Testament. And there is no reason for us to deviate from that. To call God a divine mother is a way of, I think, appeasing a certain element in the population who has a chip on their shoulder regarding feminism. I don't think there's a reason to appease people like that. I think their concerns should be addressed, but we don't appease them by calling God by names that aren't appropriate for God, like mother.
There's a difference between describing God in motherly terms and using it as an actual title. Mm-hmm. And God, you're right, God never uses a feminine title. And one thing I never really understand is the people who are so concerned about using people's pronouns are the ones who do not want to use God's preferred pronouns.
Oh, that's a great observation.
We should refer to God the way he has referred to himself in the Bible, and that's just the end of it. I mean, he's God. He's our creator, and he's the one who reveals himself to us. And I think there's a book called The Bible Among the Myths, and right now I cannot think of the author, but he actually talked about possible reason. I'm sure there are many reasons, but one of the reasons why God did not use feminine terms is because there were certain things associated with the female gods. There were fertility rites. There were certain things that surrounded those gods, or goddesses, I should say, that God did not want to be associated with who he was. Mm-hmm. And so for some background, that's one possible thing. But there's also issues of authority and issues of, as you said, Greg, being a husband. Anyway, I think there are a lot of reasons, but the bottom line is we should just refer to God the way he refers to himself.
I agree. By the way, there could have been Rodney Stark. I don't know, the historian.
It wasn't Rodney Stark.
Or Ronald Nash.
No, it wasn't. I want to say John Oswald, but I'm not sure if that's correct. The book is called The Bible Among the Myths. It's a fantastic book. And basically what he does, I've mentioned it on the show before, but he explains how the Bible was a dramatic change from the worldview of all the people around it. And mm-hmm. So he makes that case of how completely separate the Bible is from all these other things. It's a really interesting book. But you get mm-hmm. an idea of what the gods meant to them at the time and how people used their gods, you know, manipulated their gods and, mm-hmm. and their understanding of what they were doing with their rituals and that sort of thing.
I just think sometimes these are examples of encroaching feminism. And I was talking, this is a little bit off this topic, but I think there is an element here. And I do not think that Christians in our culture have realized the thoroughgoing way that feminism has influenced relationships in the church, particularly marriage. All they have to do is read 1 Peter chapter 3 and that beginning section where Peter addresses the responsibilities of wives to husbands. And it is jarring to 20th or 21st century sensibilities because what Peter says is you ought to act, ladies, wives, like the women, godly women of old, which including calling your husband Lord. Now, there's a qualification there, you know, and that is in a certain sense, that didn't mean like he was the Lord God, but there was this sensibility about it. You know, men were properly in charge in families. That's the biblical teaching, and it's very straightforward and explicit. Now, men have responsibilities, too, towards wives in that. The irony is that there is much more said about women, and their responsibility to be submissive and responsive to the clear veto power authority of their husbands in their lives. And this is largely disregarded in many Christian relationships. Even relationships where people, where the couples believe in a biblical patriarchy, a compatibilistic, I'm not sure what the right word is here, you know, that there's a hierarchy, but they're not, it's not egalitarian way of approaching those relationships, but a I'm looking at Amy for the answer here, but
complementarian.
There it is, complementarian. But, and what I was thinking is, and I was talking about certain relationships and to another Christian woman, and she said, well, you know, we're all very fallen, you know, and women are supposed to respond to their husband this way, but, you know, that's really hard, and that's kind of fallen. And it just seems to me, this is what came to mind, I do not think that this same woman would have said the same thing about a husband who was involved in pornography. Well, you know, men are men, and, you know, they have this, they wouldn't be so sympathetic to that. Well, that's just the way fallen people work. No, this is going to be to get out of that, quit doing that, which I'm sympathetic to that response, but the response isn't to women who are wearing the pants of the family. What you're doing is dead wrong. This is a violation of what God teaches. You know, we got to fix this. No, there's all kinds of sympathy towards that. Anyway, it's another issue, but I think there is a kinship here, to this question in that a kind of a false type of inappropriate feminism has found its way into the minds from the culture into the minds of Christians, and it functions in their lives. And these are two examples of it. You know, calling God a woman is one way. I think the other example is much more inimical, more dangerous, more damaging. But
I want to come back to what you were just talking about in a second. But I think one of the things that could be behind this desire to call him Divine Mother is this need that people have now for everything to look like them. So women don't want to feel left out, so therefore we must call God Divine Mother so they don't feel left out. And there are so many problems with this, but at the first one that comes to mind is God is not like us. If you're trying to make God look like you because that's how you feel accepted, there something has gone very wrong mm-hmm. in this situation. God is himself we do not need God to look like us in order for us to have a relationship with him and to know that he loves us.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first thing. Secondly,
can I say quickly to
yeah,
that?
Go ahead.
He came, he went in the incarnation, carnation is a product that you drink. In the incarnation, not the flower, he does become like us in ways that are relevant to relate to him, okay? But that's the incarnate word, Jesus. But the Father, God in himself, is not. He's other, and some would say he's completely other. We only know him, about him, analogically to ways he describes himself, like even characterizing himself as a father is an analogical way. It's an indirect way of understanding him, but it's the way he chose to describe mm-hmm. himself.
Thank you for bringing up the incarnation, because of course Jesus did become like us.
God with us.
But even with Jesus, we still need to come to him as he is and know him as he is, as the fullest representation of the Father. We don't need to try to make him more like, I don't need to make him like me personally in order to feel validated or whatever mm-hmm. that is. Mm-hmm. So the second thing I wanted to say, since we kind of got off track a little bit in patriarchy, but I just wanted to throw out there too, because those ideas are so countercultural to where we are right now in society. So I have a couple of pieces on our website at str.org called The Beauty of Submission and The Beauty of Leadership. Because I do strongly believe that there is a hierarchy, but it is something that's beautiful. And when it works really well. And I give some examples of where this happens in life, where the hierarchy is meant for our good. And I also wanted to point out that this is all in the context of what Jesus illustrated to us in terms of power. Jesus explained that to the greatest among us is the servant among us. He came to serve, not to be served. So he gave us this whole idea of dying for his bride, of serving his bride, of loving his bride in a self-sacrificial way. So every hierarchy we imagine has to be in light of the Christian view of leadership and power, which is servanthood.
Mm-hmm.
So even those who are making the decisions are acting as a servant. And so those are some things to keep in mind.
I think the leadership side is much more difficult, because as a leader, to serve, you trust God and respond to the leadership. To lead, you have to make decisions that are for the good of everyone, and then you have to execute those decisions even when they're unpopular. So I actually think that's harder. But in any event, there is this constant effort to usurp the leadership, and there's implications of this that go back to the fall, that this is going to be the case. I do think it's interesting, and again, this is all just in this very, very broad area. When you watch movies, shows and everything now, women are everywhere in prominent roles that men used to be in. Now, sometimes there's no impropriety about it. But that they have women everywhere in these action roles. And I made an observation about this, and this along the feminism line. I think this is part of the impulse. There's no difference between men and women. Women can do everything that men can do. Watch, and we'll make these characters in Hollywood make it so. Of course, in Hollywood, you could do anything you want. You could have a 90-pound young lady throw 150-pound, 200-pound guys all over the place and be really tough, and this is the way they do it. But I want you to notice something. They have not helped women be women. They have transformed women into men. Women act like men in these things. They do the things that men do. They don't do the things that women do. Protect and care for and multiply. They do the things that men do, break, kill, destroy. And they talk the way men do. the same foul language. They're harsh. They're irreverent about death, and they say, bang, 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 they shoot these guys. It doesn't bother them a bit, you know. So we can be we can become men, is what they're saying. The feminist emphasis there does not exalt women. It says we are going to change women into men, and that's the only way we could be, quote-unquote, equal.
Well, there you go. You got an extra question, a bonus question answered there in between these questions. Okay. So here's a question from Jim. On a recent hashtag STR ask, you explained why, quote, I'm offended is a meaningless ploy. What are some tactical ways to address this ploy when someone uses it against you?
That's good. Well, the first question, you say I'm offended, is what is it that offends you here? And why? And a lot depends on the nature of the question. But what are you offended about? I'm curious. What are you offended about? All right. And the second thing that comes to mind is when they say, "Well, you said this, and I was offended." You have to ask yourself whether it was offensive or not. Whether what you said was offensive, because there's a difference between giving offense and taking offense. And now people are very prone to take offense if they don't like your ideas, all right? Now, this goes broadly into the area of the critical theory and the sense of inclusion. And frankly, this is an insight I got from Peter Boghossian, who talked about it online. The atheist, who is also very resistant and outspoken against a lot of this crazy indoctrination that's happening in the universities. It's why he left Portland State and resigned. And what he says is what inclusion means is that people are meant to feel comfortable just as they are in any way they want to be. So whatever they choose as an expression of their authentic self, if somebody is making them feel uncomfortable about that choice or that point of view or attitude, then they are not being included. And therefore, the one who is making them feel uncomfortable ought to be silent. So this is part of what inclusion means. This is where the whole concept of snowflakes is coming from, and trigger alerts and all this. This is going to make you feel uncomfortable if you listen to it. Then you will not feel included, and then you will not feel valued. This is the way that value system is kind of structured. So when somebody says, "I feel offended," what they may be expressing is, "What you said is something I don't agree with. When you said it, I felt less than or offended because your ideology is different than mine. Therefore, I don't feel included. This is not a safe place for me to be." Why isn't it safe? Because you disagree with me. That's what it amounts to. And this is called oppression by ideology. And it is a part of the critical race theory kind of like world, if you will. Even if you don't call it CRT, it's built into all of this way of looking at things. And so it is not an act of oppression. I punched the guy in the face. I told him he had to sit in the back of the room. I said, "He can't be here at all. Get out of here. You must be silent." No, it was just that I voiced something that he didn't like, that he disagreed with, that he felt he offended. So this has become a standard way of silencing the approach. So the question then, first one is, what has it offended you? And why is that offensive? Getting more detail, Columbo style. And then another one, why is, this is where judgment has to be made. Depends what you hear. If you did say something in a genuinely offensive fashion, and here we kind of have to go to old school offensive to assess this, not new school, which is, "I disagreed with what you say." Well, too bad, you know, if you get out of the kitchen kind of thing. If the uh, he whatever gets too hot. But if it's old school and you did say something inappropriate, used language that was not appropriate and was impolite, which, by the way, the left is especially careless about, not the conservative side. In any event, if you did do that, you apologize. If it wasn't, say, why would that be offensive to you? Why would me saying this be offensive to you? So you're just, the tactical maneuver is just to figure out what the heck is going on here, you know, and get to the heart of it. And then if you think that the challenge is an inappropriate challenge to you, you could just, then you just turn it around and say, if I was offended by what you told me, would you retract your own view? I mean, it could be that I'm offended, that he was offended for the reasons he was offended. Does that mean now I have a claim upon him in some way? Okay, now you have to be silent because your words offend me. Does it work that way? Those are the kinds of questions tactically I would ask. I think this is just a silly maneuver. It is, if it's a demand that Christians be polite in a classic sense, that I think it's appropriate, but this is something that leftism characteristically does not hold as a value. That's why they scream at you and there's epithets of all sorts and name-calling and vicious action that's meant to hurt you and offend you. So it isn't as if not offending people is a value of that community. You know, if you're like you're in a religious environment, you know, and so we never say things that would bother people, you know, and now you're saying something that bothers people. You shouldn't do that. That bothers a lot of people. Well, that would be one thing, but this isn't their culture. They're saying all, but it's a way of silencing dissent by focusing on a character flaw. It's just a name-calling thing. That's what's going on. Silence dissent by identifying what you think is a character flaw. You are an offensive person. You speak offensively. Be quiet. Don't say these things. I think that's part of what's going on here.
I haven't encountered this in a while, so I'm not sure what I would do or how people would respond to this. I guess I don't really have a whole lot of hope that people care about truth anymore so much. But if you were to say, if they say they're offended, are you saying that what I said was wrong, or are you just saying you don't like it?
Good one.
Because I don't decide what is right and what is wrong or what is true and what is false by what I like. So is that how you decide those things? I'm just trying to figure out if it's worth having a conversation over this. Because if you can make that distinction between true and false and like and don't like and possibly move it on to true and false, I think that's your best bet. And then maybe you could even say, let's just put our feelings aside, because obviously whenever we disagree with something, we're going to feel uncomfortable. Let's just put those feelings aside and let's look for the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how that would work, but I'd be curious if you try that and it works for you or it doesn't work for you. I'd love to hear about it, because mm-hmm. I would love to have more hope that our society cares about truth. And I pray for that all the time. It's just, it's such a weird time, Greg.
Yeah. Keep in mind here, this is a caveat, and we're almost out of time, but I wanted to add this. And that is, when we give tactical suggestions, we are giving tactical suggestions that seem appropriate to the circumstances, that get at the truth in a clever way, and that try in an appropriate way to box people into the narrow corner of the truth so they can't get out. That does not mean that it's going to be persuasive for them. It isn't like we're saying, well, this is what will work with this person, but rather this is a way to appropriately respond in the circumstance, and then we'll see what happens. Rather than be flat-footed with nothing to say, here's how we can go to try to unwrap an illicit response. Whether they respond to it or not in that way is a different matter.
Well, thank you, Greg, and thank you for your questions, Arhal and Jim. We appreciate that. And we'd love to hear from you. Send us your question on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.